Chapter 5. Finding Your Work. You could not step twice into the same river, for other waters are ever flowing on to you. Heraclitus, circa 540 through 480 BC. The world displays perfect neutrality on whether we achieve any outward manifestation of our inner desires, but not art. Art is exquisitely responsive. Nowhere is feedback so absolute as in the making of art. The work we make, even if unnoticed and undesired by the world, vibrates in perfect harmony to everything we put into it or withhold from it. In the outside world, there may be no reaction to what we do. In our artwork, there is nothing but reaction. The breathtakingly wonderful things about this reaction is its truthfulness. Look at your work, and it tells you how it is when you hold back or when you embrace. When you are lazy, your art is lazy. When you hold back, it holds back. When you hesitate, it stands there, staring, hands in its pockets. But when you commit, it comes on like blazes. Recently, out of pleasure alone, an accomplished visual artist took up dance. Never before experiencing an art form so purely physical, she threw herself into it. Her involvement became intense, more classes, more practice, more commitments, longer hours. She excelled. Then, one day, several months into it, her instructor asked her to consider joining a performing troupe. She froze. Her dancing fell apart. She became stiff and self-conscious. She got serious, or serious in a different way. She didn't feel she was good enough, and her dancing promptly was not good enough. She got frustrated and depressed, even though she had quit for weeks to sort things out. More recently, back to work on new but shaky ground, she's having to teach herself to enjoy working hard for others at the art she previously enjoyed passionately for herself. In the ideal, that is to say real, artists, fears not only continue to exist, they exist side by side with the desire that complement them, perhaps drive them, certainly feed them. Naive passion, which promotes work done in ignorance of obstacles, becomes, with courage, informed passion, which promotes work done in full acceptance of those obstacles. Foremost among those obstacles is uncertainty. We all know the feeling of finished art that rides from within its uncertainties. Music, with its dense structure and built-in abstraction, offers the clearest examples. In performance of really wonderful music, there's an ongoing tension between where the musical line is and where we know it needs to go. We're uncertain, momentarily, just how the fugue can be resolved, even as, simultaneously, we know it will be. What is more difficult to describe is the state of mind held by the artist while working on the piece. Most artists keep a well-rehearsed speech close at hand for fielding the unfamiliar request to explain a finished piece. But if asked to describe how it felt during the art making, well, that often comes out a bit like Dorothy trying to describe the Land of Oz to Auntie M. Between the initial idea and the finished piece lies a gulf we can see across, but never fully chart. The truly special moments in art making lie in those moments when concept is converted to reality. Those moments when the gulf is being crossed. Precise descriptions fail, but it connects to that wonderful condition in which the work seems to make itself, and the artist serves only as guide or mediator, allowing all things to be possible. All things considered, in most matters of art, it is more nourishing to be a maker than a viewer, but not in all matters. When it comes to the range of art we can usefully engage, some benefits that flow freely to art viewers remain tantalizingly inaccessible to art makers. As you listen, you can be transported to authentic ecstasy and catharsis by a performance of the Bach B minor Mass. But as maker, you cannot compose even the most trivial piece of authentic Baroque music. As a viewer, You can feel the charge in the presence of the Plains Indian medicine bundle. But as a 20th century artist, you could not begin to make one yourself. Your reach as viewer is vastly greater than you reach as a maker. The art you can experience may have originated 1,000 miles away or 1,000 years ago, but the art you can make is irrevocably bound to the time and place of your life. Limited by the very ground on which you stand, without a broadly shared belief in the symbolism of the cross and the promise of heaven above, the cruciform design and towering spires of the great European cathedrals would have made no sense whatsoever. Seen against the vast sweep of history, it is only for brief moments that particular events and beliefs carry the power to compel us to build cathedrals or write fugues. And it's just as likely that a similarly narrow, albeit different, range of beliefs drives all that is authentically available to us in this moment. Decisive works of art participate directly in the fabric of history surrounding their maker. Simply put, you have to be there. The surprising and probably disturbing corollary to this is that we don't learn much about making art from being moved by it. Making art is bound by where we are, and the experience of art we have as viewers is not a reliable guide to where we are. As viewers, we readily experience the power of ground on which we cannot stand, yet that very experience can be so compelling that we may feel almost honor-bound to make art that recaptures that power, or more dangerously, feel tempted to use the same techniques, the same subjects, the same symbols as appear in the work that arouse our passion, to borrow, in effect, a charge from another time and place. It's not hard to track the source of such desire. Our most personal histories hold crystalline memories of absorption into evocative work. Sometimes such moments are part of why we become artists, and the works that moved us take on heroic importance. I can remember to within one heartbeat the moment I first saw an Edward Weston print, as I was walking the dim hallway that leads up to the rare book room of the UCLA library. I glanced up and saw this photograph. I stopped walking. Confusion. It was unlike anything else I had seen. It was so much more something than other photographs, particularly my photographs. It was different in kind. In that instant, an unbidden distinction formed in my gut. There were now two kinds of photographs in the world, the one before me on the wall and the rest. That photograph was mine to experience, but neither it nor anything like it was mine to make. Yet it took a decade to dispel that gnawing feeling that my work should do what that work had done. And more years still before I thought to question where the power of such art resided. In the maker? In the artwork? In the viewer? If, indeed, for any given time only a certain sort of work resonates with life, then that is the work you need to be doing in that moment. If you try to do some other work, you will miss your moment. Indeed, our own work is so inextricably tied to time and place that we cannot recapture even our own aesthetic ground of past times. Try, if you can, to reoccupy your own aesthetic space of a few years back, or even a few months. There is no way. You can only plunge ahead, even when that carries with it the bittersweet realization that you have already done your very best work. This heightened self-consciousness was rarely an issue in earlier times when it seemed self-evident that the artist, and everyone else for that matter, had roots deeply intertwining their culture. Meanings and distinctions embodied within artwork were part of the fabric of everyday life, and the distance from art issues to all other issues was small. The whole population counted as audience when artists' work encompassed everything from icons for the church to utensils for the home. In the Greek amphitheater, 2,200 years ago, the plays of Euripides were performed as contemporary theater before an audience of 14,000. Not so today. Today, art issues have, for the most part, become solely the concern of artists, divorced from and ignored by the larger community. Today, artists often back away from engaging the times and places of their life, choosing instead the largely intellectual challenge of engaging the times and places of art. But it's an artificial construct that begins and ends at the gallery door. Apart from the readership of Art Forum, remarkably few people lose sleep trying to incorporate gender-neutral biomorphic deconstructivism into their personal lives. As Adam Gopnik remarked in The New Yorker, postmodernism art is, above all, post-audience art. In such a setting, artists strain to find material of any human consequence. Under pressure of impending irrelevance, they may begin to fill their canvases and monitors with charged particles appropriated from other places and times. It is as though art itself confers universality upon its subject, as though in art all objects automatically retain their power, as though you could incorporate the power of the Plains Indian medicine bundle into your work, or convincingly complete the closing movements to Schubert's unfinished symphony. Today, indeed, you can find urban white artists, people who could not reliably tell a coyote from a German shepherd at 100 feet, casually incorporate the figure of a coyote the trickster into their work. A premise common to all such efforts is that power can be borrowed across space and time. It cannot. There's a difference between meaning that is embodied and meaning that is referenced. As someone once said, no one should wear a Greek fisherman's hat except a Greek fisherman. Canon. If you're like most artists we know, you're probably accustomed to watching your work unfold smoothly enough for long stretches of time, until one day, for no immediate apparent reason, it doesn't. Hitting that unexpected rift is commonplace to the point of cliché. Yet artists commonly treat each recurring instance as somber evidence of their own personal failure. Nominees for leading role in continuing artist's funk are 1. You've entirely run out of new ideas forever, or 2. You've been following a worthless dead-end path the whole time. And the winner is, fortunately, neither. One of the best-kept secrets of art-making is that new ideas come into play far less frequently than practical ideas. Ideas that can be reused for 1,000 variations, supplying the framework for a whole body of work rather than a single piece. And likewise, fear that you've been following the wrong ideas is merely the downside variant of common fantasies about the way things could have been. The promise of paths not taken is that our work is really more than it appears, that it would shine through better if only things had been a little different. Confronting a disappointing piece, one somehow wants to disown it, to say, that's not what I meant to do. I should have made it larger, or maybe smaller. If only I had more time or money or hadn't used that stupid green paint. We'd all love to squirm out of this one, but the undeniable fact is that your art is not some residue left when you subtract all the things you haven't done. It is the full payoff for all the things you have done. One might as well wish for indulgence to go back and pick better numbers for last week's lottery. Time travelers and tabloid psychics aside, the rest of us directly engage only today. And when you watch your work unfold day by day, piece by piece, there's no escaping cause and effect. Simply put, what you did got you here, and if you apply that same method again, you'll likely get the same result again. This is true not just for being stuck, but for all other artistic states as well, including highly productive states. As a practical matter, ideas and methods that work usually continue to work. If you are working smoothly and now you are stuck, chances are you unnecessarily altered some approach that was already working perfectly well. For years, I set aside daytimes for art making and evenings for writing. At some point, I reversed that schedule, and months passed before I realized my writing had dried up. not for lack of ideas, but because it turns out I process words better at midnight than at midday. When things go haywire, your best opening strategy might be to return, very carefully and consciously, to the habits and practices in play the last time you felt good about the work. Return to the space you drifted away from, and sometimes at least, the work will return as well. And sometimes it won't. Artists, like everyone else, have a certain conceptual inertia, a tendency to keep their own compass heading even as the world itself veers off in another direction. When Columbus returned from the New World and proclaimed the Earth was round, almost everyone else went right along believing the Earth was flat. Then they died, and the next generation grew up believing the world was round. That's how people change their minds. That's also to say that usually, but not always, the piece you produce tomorrow will be shaped purely and simply by the tools you hold in your hand today. In that sense, the history of art is also the history of technology. The frescoes of pre-Renaissance Italy, the tempera paintings of Flanders, the plein air oils of southern France, the acrylics of New York City, each successive technology imparted characteristic color and saturation, brushstroke and texture, sensuality or formality to the art piece. Simply put, certain tools make certain results possible. Your tools do more than just influence the appearance of the resulting art. They basically set limits upon what you can say with an art piece. And when particular tools and materials disappear, because knowledge of how to make or use them is lost, artistic possibilities are lost as well. The sound of Baroque instruments, the impressions of the letterpress, the tonality of platinum prints, count these among the endangered species of art making. And likewise, when new tools appear, new artistic possibilities arise. A scene painted from life, for instance, reveals a world far different from the one painted from memory. This became evident in the 1870s when manufacturers found a way to seal oil colors in collapsible metal foil tubes. And for the first time, artists working in that medium had the option of leaving the studio and painting with oils directly in the field. Some did, and some didn't. Those who did became known as the Impressionists. The dilemma every artist confronts again and again is when to stick with familiar tools and materials and when to reach out and embrace those that offer new possibilities. And on average, the younger artist tends to experiment with a large and varied range of tools and materials, while the veteran artist tends to employ a small and specific set. In time, as an artist's gestures become more assured, the chosen tool become almost an extension of the artist's own spirit. In time, exploration gives way to expression. Either way, however, there is always one large obstacle to making mid-course corrections in our working methods. We hardly know what the methods themselves are. And when the work is going well, why on earth would we want to know? Most of the myriad of steps that go into making a piece, or a year's worth of pieces, go on below the level of conscious thought, engaging unarticulated beliefs and assumptions about what art making is. They remain as unknown and unconsidered as the steps we take in deciding whether to burnish the plate with straight or with circular strokes. Ask yourself why, for instance, you listen to country western music while you're painting. Does it encourage you to choose brighter colors? Why do you leave your studio unheated even when it means working with your overcoat on? Does it make your brush strokes crisper? How do you sense when the dampened paper wants to take the watercolors? By touch, smell, the limpness of the paper? We rarely think about how or why we do such things. We just do them. Changing the pattern of outcome in your work means first identifying things about your approach that are as automatic as wedging the clay, as subtle as releasing the arrow from a bow. The details of art making we do recognize tend to be hard-won practical working habits and recurring bits of form that we can repeatedly hang work on. Sometimes, on dull days, I've said to myself half aloud that if I just go into the studio and start a wet piece, I'll at least have to finish something before it dries. We use predictable work habits to get us into the studio and into our materials. We use recurrent bits of form as starting points for making specific pieces. Considering the number of Musarkas he wrote, we have to think that once Chopin found that musical form, he must have been a happier composer. It's easy to imagine that he could sit at the piano most of the time and begin to vamp in that oddly syncopated three-quarter time, gradually building it into a small-scale piece. For Chopin, that form was so conductive to exploration and variation, he was able to reuse it for years. Equally, it must have been just plain helpful when J.S. Bach committed to writing a prelude and fugue in each of the 24 keys, since each time he sat down to compose, he had at least a place to start. Let's see, I haven't begun to work on the F-sharp minor yet. Working within the self-imposed discipline of a particular form eases the prospect of having to reinvent yourself with each new piece. The discovery of useful forms is precious. Once found, they should never be abandoned for trivial reasons. It's easy to imagine today's art instructor cautioning Chopin that the Musarkas thing is getting a little repetitive, that the work is not progressing. Well, true, it may not have been progressing, but that's not the issue. Writing Musarkas may have been useful only to Chopin as a vehicle for getting back into the work and as a place to begin making the next piece. For most artists, making good art depends on making lots of art, and any device that carries the first brush stroke to next blank canvas has tangible, practical value. Only the maker, and then only with time, has a chance of knowing how important small conventions and rituals are in the practice of staying at work. The private details of art making are utterly uninteresting to audiences and frequently to teachers, perhaps because they're almost never visible or even knowable from examining the finished work. Hemingway, for instance, mounted his typewriter at counter height and did all his writing while standing up. If he wasn't standing, he wasn't typing. Of course, that odd habit isn't visible in his stories, but were he denied that habit, there probably wouldn't be any stories. The hardest part of art making is living your life in such a way that your work gets done over and over. And that means, among other things, finding a host of practices that are just plain useful. A piece of art is the surface expression of a life lived within productive patterns. Over time, the life of a productive artist becomes filled with useful conventions and practical methods so that a string of finished pieces continues to appear at the surface. And in truly happy moments, those artistic gestures move beyond simple procedure and acquire an inherent aesthetic all their own. They are your artistic hearth and home, the working places to be that link form and feeling. They become, like the dark colors and asymmetrical lilt of the Musarka, inseparable from the life of their maker. They are canons. They allow confidence and concentration. They allow not knowing. They allow the automatic and unarticulated to remain so. Once you have found the work you are meant to do, the particulars of any single piece don't matter all that much. End of chapter 5.